Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDilling. I'm here with Jay Christoph and Bronwyn Illy.
Hello.
Jay, thanks for coming in to see us today.
Thanks for having me back again. It's always fun.
You are here because you have wonderfully written the second book in the Nevernight series, God's Grave. Can you tell the podcast listeners just a little bit about God's Grave before we all start raving about how much we loved it?
Okay, so it's the sequel to Nevernight. It picks up shortly after the events of the first novel. And Mia basically sells herself to a gladiatorial college in order to get a very limited and brief shot at killing two of the men that she's sworn her revenge against. But in the process of doing so, she finds out a lot about the face of her world and the shape of her reality. Basically, over the course of the book, she finds out that everything she believed to be true is a lie, and that kind of causes her to reassess who she is and what she wants.
I very much loved what a game changer of a novel this book is. Because we think we're in one place, then we realize everything's
then
different.
Jay Christoph sucker punches us, and
and we're left kind of with this new sort of twist of the kaleidoscope where everything looks different. And
That was kind of the idea. Like the first book, you set up the perception, and the second book, you kind of shatter that perception, and the character is left to ask at the end, well, who am I now? What do I do now? What do I want now?
She's also, I thought, character development in this was sensational, because we've got a character who kills a lot of people.
she is
an assassin, and the questions surrounding that and the morality surrounding that are explored a lot more in this book than in the first book. Like, not that they weren't explored in the first book, but you've just gone to a deeper level in this one.
I mean that's one of the real challenges I found anyway writing an assassin. You know, a person who killed someone else for money, it's about as morally reprehensible a thing as you can possibly do. So having someone who's engaging in that kind of activity, but at the same time keeping them sympathetic, that to me was the challenge of the book, and really the challenge of the series, because she does some pretty awful things over the course of these two books. But at the same time, you want the reader to be rooting for her. She's the protagonist. If you don't like the protagonist of the book, why are you reading the series? So that's the tightrope you've kind of got to walk. And, you know, I think people like the fact that she is so ruthless, but she still has to maintain a semblance of humanity. She can't become the people that she's hunting. And that's kind of the challenge for her as well.
It's like the science of an anti-hero, and how you are able to have morally questionable people who are still heroes.
Personally, I think it all comes down to her reasoning. Like, you know, she's an assassin, but she's doing it because she was hurt, her family was murdered, and these people are not good people. It's not like she's going out there assassinating, really.
Where do you draw the line?
I know. Right. And so I think that's the reason why, personally, I can look at it and be like, yes, she's an assassin, but her reasons behind it, I can understand.
Sure, but I mean, at the same time, those reasons are supremely selfish.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, she's attempting to behead a republic. She's trying to kill the two most important people in the entire republic. Logically speaking, when those people die, if those people die, that will create a tremendous power vacuum. Mm-hmm. There'll be a whole bunch more misery and murder that stems from those two deaths.
And who does she step on to get to them as
to get to them, exactly. Like, what does she need to do to get there? She doesn't think about that.
No.
So she is a supremely selfish person in that respect. That's kind of what I like about her, and it's kind of what readers like about her. She doesn't really make apologies for that either. She doesn't ever really attempt to justify it. She's just happy with that aspect of her personality.
And that's something that she might, like, you expect when you start it, that's a lesson she's going to learn on the way. And she's going to realize, maybe I'm not doing the right thing, even though it, you know, might feel good for me. And, you know, when I finally slit his throat, and I feel like, yes, I've avenged my family. But, yeah, and I feel like it's starting to get a bit of that in God's Grave.
I think it's just really a good thing that she has such a great snarky sense of humor and such snappy one-liners. And
that makes her endearing.
Amazing, like, awesome feats of unexpected heroism to offset all of this.
Yes.
Right, yeah. I mean, humor is a pretty good shortcut to affection. Okay. So, yeah, keeping her funny. And I think that's one of the key roles that Mr. Kindly and Eclipse, who are her two companions, her shadow demons, that's the kind of the role they play as well. They're both they serve as a conscience for her, but they're also kind of comedic foils at the same time. They'll point out what she's doing is stupid or selfish or whatever, but they'll do it in a hopefully funny way anyway.
Yeah. They were hilarious. I loved their little
arguments.
Their
banter was great.
That was awesome.
I mean, the cats and dogs, they're going to fight.
Shadow cats, shadow dogs. They'll still fight.
Now, this could potentially be a spoiler, so if you would prefer to not go to Kia, then just say, next question, please. But would you be willing to talk a little bit about a new character in the novels that Mia meets called Furion? Or would you rather not discuss him at all?
I mean, yeah, we can talk a little bit about it.
Yeah.
So Furion is... he's a Darkin like Mia. So the idea is that there are people in the world known as Darkin who have the ability to manipulate shadows, and they don't really know why, they don't really know how. There's not many of them, and there isn't some grand bank of knowledge or master, Jedi master, that they can go and learn about themselves with. So they kind of learn who they are and what they can do through trial and error. But Furion is one of the gladiators in the Collegium that Mia sells herself to. And he, you know, she initially thinks he's going to be someone who can teach her about herself, but he turns out to be someone who's radically different to her and wants very different things from her. So he kind of becomes an antagonist, I guess, for her over the course of the novel. But he has some pretty dark secrets and some horrible things in his past. He has very good reasons for being the way he is, but he's kind of like, to me, are what Mr. Kindly is to Eclipse. They're just complete moral opposites. And so while they could help each other and could be good for each other, they just end up at each other's throats constantly.
And I think that's what makes him such a good foil for Mia, is that he's not just like he's not just in opposition to her. He's got really sort of compelling reasons for being the way that he is.
Yeah,
even
he has a very strict morality. Yeah,
yeah.
And like, I'm sure readers will hate his guts after reading him for a little while, but I wanted the reasons for him being the way he was to be kind of crystal clear. Like, by the end, hopefully you can see why he did the things he did and why he thought the way he thought.
It makes
He's a product of his environment.
Yeah. I love a good character that is fun to hate, the ones where you literally want to jump into the book and
actually
like
yeah.
change
yeah.
and they never do. Like, I really enjoyed him. I really enjoyed a lot of the new characters here, actually. Like, you've taken Mia out away from everyone, really, like most people that we had in the first book.
Yeah.
And dropped her in a new environment with new people, and they've all got really interesting little relationships going on. And I would love to talk about all of them, but maybe then I would just be retelling the whole story.
Yeah.
But,
she meets some interesting people.
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge of any sequel. Like, the initial temptation is to keep the novel in the setting of the first book, because a lot of people like the first book, and you spend a great deal of time establishing the way the Red Church worked and who the teachers were and their various personal interactions and foibles, but... Mm. I mean, I felt like Mia's perspective needed to get broader, and by doing that, I chose to use a broader lens and show, you know, instead of focusing on the Red Church, we focus on the City of God's Grave and to a lesser extent, the world around it. So, you know, in the third book, the scope is going to grow further still, and it'll be kind of a regional view, a regional story. So we've gone from a school to a city to a country, I guess, is the planned level of extension. Anyway. Right. That's the theory anyway. I haven't written the third one yet. So
but you know more about it than anyone else.
True that.
Not necessarily a lot. No, I know exactly what I'm doing. It'll be great. I'll start writing it next month. So.
You heard it here.
It's going to be fantastic.
Now, I know we talked about this last time, but just again, for people who haven't read Nevernight and are thinking about going into the series, one of the joys for me is the beautiful footnotes, which I just...
My favourite.
They're such a source of joy. And, like, ordinarily speaking, like, I'm a reader who would maybe skip over footnotes.
Sure.
And even when the action is at its... craziest, when there's a footnote in these books, I go there because I know that it's going to be amazing. I just know that it's going to be like, some little pearl of hilariousness.
It's, like, it's so funny and it's personal. It's not like your footnotes in any other kind of story. It's not like
boring information you don't need. It's always like, here's some superfluous information that I'm going to deliver to you.
In a very comical way.
That enriches the world and makes you laugh. And one of my favourite ones, and I'm going to tread around this in a non-spoilery way a bit, intense action is happening, characters' lives hang in the balance. You go on a little footnote about like the seven wonders of.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and make a joke at the end.
that I was amazed that you stopped to read the footnote of the horse race. Yeah.
And then so am I. And then I'm laughing. And then I have to go back to the life or death situation with a big grin on my face.
That was kind of me poking fun at myself, I guess. It's weird. Like the footnotes are. Some people tell me that they'd skip them. Particularly the first time they read it and then they go back and read the book again with the footnotes. I structured them in a way where you don't have to read them if you don't want. It's pure world building with a little bit of narrative voice and humor thrown in. Like I used them primarily as moments of levity, because if I didn't try and make the book funny, hopefully it is funny, then it could be exceedingly grim. And so I wanted to try and lighten the mood with these notes and
it
with the voice
works.
And the narrator.
Yeah, you managed to be grim and hilarious.
First, when I got my proof copy and at work, I went on lunch and I started reading it, and within like the first couple of lines, I was already smiling and laughing.
Good.
And,
I'm glad.
You know, it just works so well.
I learned my lesson with Nevernight, because I did on my first read of Nevernight be like, footnotes, that's cute, I'm going to keep reading the story.
Yeah, right.
Into this story. And then the second time I read it with the footnotes, and it was like, oh, there's so much more going on here. And I should have read the whole
thing. I had to read
this time around. I read the whole thing. I didn't skip any footnotes, and I just think that's the way to do it for anyone who's looking for advice.
I mean, like, I was kind of the same way with Terry Pratchett is probably the most infamous user of footnotes. And I used to, the first time I would go through his novels, I would skip them and then go back on the reread and kind of soak in that world building, that extra level of granularity, because I was often quite caught up in the story and I just wanted to find out what happened next. But I mean, it hopefully works on both levels. If you want to skip them altogether, you're probably not missing out on a hell of a lot, except maybe some
chuckles.
Yeah, some puerile humor and a few giggles, yeah. But. There's nothing in there that you absolutely must know. It's just like I grew up reading kind of epic doorstopper fantasies, like huge bricks of books that you could, you know, beat a burglar to death with if they broke into your house and you happen to have it sitting on the nightstand next to you. And I love that level of granularity in fantasy in particular, but I understand that some people just don't. Some people aren't interested in why the coinage is called what it is, or where this particular fighting style originated, or how the political system works. They just want to get to the murders. And that's fine. If that's the way you want to read it, then you can skip the notes and there'll be plenty of murder and everyone will be happy.
And then you've got something waiting for you when you reread.
Yeah.
Right, if you do reread, yeah, absolutely.
But it feels different with this because the footnotes, it's a character
right.
to me.
Yes,
it's, and
we
I,
were
I
arguing
want,
about this before the podcast.
Yeah. Who is the character?
The narrator here, someone that... I thought the narrator was... I, for some reason, and I could be totally wrong, thought that the narrator was Mr. Kindly.
Right.
Is that not correct? Because
or don't
reading
say
this
it
time, I noticed
it.
That actually sometimes the narrator is talking about Mr. Kindly, so then maybe it's not him.
But
the identity of the narrator is secret. You'll find out definitely who it is in book three. I know who it is. I've kind of known who it is since the start, but... There's meant to be a little bit of ambiguity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Conceivably, it could be Mr. Kindly, it could be Trick, it could be Mercurio, it could be Alias. It's probably male.
It's someone
the
we've
tone
met.
Is male.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You have been introduced to the narrator already.
Okay. Right.
Yes. Okay. Because that's one of the things, and that's why I want to read them in particular, is because it's important part of the story. It's someone I know.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not just some chunk of information. It is another character speaking to me, and I want to know what they're saying because it helps develop who they are.
Right. And there are clues insofar as the meta plot, kind of the plot beneath the plot, the plot that's going to get resolved in book three. I keep dropping my water. You're out there in the audience wondering what those thumping noises are. There's a there are clues to the meta plot, and there's clues to the narrator's identity in the way they refer to themselves and refer to the people around them as well. But I think in retrospect, readers will probably look back and say, oh, I see it now, but I don't think I've been so obvious that people will know for certain yet. I've heard some really interesting theories.
It wasn't until I spoke about it with Bronwyn today, literally, that I was like, I never really even thought about this.
I never thought it was someone that we'd already met. Well, I mean, it could have been, but I thought it was just going to be someone else, and then we were going to get introduced maybe in the third book.
Right.
I kind of just thought it was this omnipotent, like, sarcastic narrator. And then when you're like, who's the narrator? I was like, but is it Mr. Kindly? Like, I don't know.
I can see maybe it's Mr. Kindly, yeah. But...
Like, the structure, it's hard to talk about this without getting into super spoilers, but at some point during the narrative. I just got off the plane, sorry. In the narrative, the narrator is almost aware that they're telling you a story. Like, they're referring to you, the reader.
Yeah.
They know they're in a book. So that's a clue.
Like, I need to read this.
I know, I'm going to read it again.
There's a definite fourth wall thing happening. The narrator is aware that they are telling you a story. And they are aware that you don't live in the world that narrator does.
This is getting into large questions that I know we can't get answers to. I'm going to ask them anyway, just so that you can say, I can't tell you, Sarah.
Sure.
But, like, the beautiful thing about these books, so I've read the first one twice, and I've read this one once, and I want to now go back to the beginning and read them both. That doesn't come up that often. Like, I don't normally reread books that often, but this one has this beautiful thing where you get the sense when you're reading both books that... this is gonna stray into sentences that I can't finish because even I can't articulate what I mean. Basically, you get this sense of grand movements happening and like little drops here and there, prophecies about the many becoming one, and references to the three sons,
right?
And all of this stuff giving you like the hazy picture of this grand scale thing that we're moving towards, and I can never pin it down. Like, I can never quite get it, and when I think I'm starting to get a clear picture, it skitters away from me, and I love how tricky that is.
That's one of the frustrations for me as well. Typically in fantasy you will at some point meet a mentor figure, like someone who knows more about what is happening than you do, who can explain at least a little bit about where you're going and where this is all going to end. But Mia hasn't really found that character at all. She's kind of bumbling her way, hopefully looking good while she's doing it, but she's still bumbling her way through this story and trying to find out who she is. She's aware now that there is something bigger, that she's part of something that she can only, see hints of. But she doesn't have... It's not like a magic book. Like, she can't sit and read the magic book
of
her life.
That's why I love it.
And I don't know if it's just because I'm not widely read enough in fantasy, but often there is a magic book. And often you can piece together where you're going and what the end game is, and that doesn't affect your enjoyment of the story because you're working within a genre that has tropes and you
sure.
can kind of... Yeah. Yeah, and so... But with yours, I can't see my way. It's hazy in a great way where it's like...
Absolutely.
I'm so pleased to be surprised and I'm so enjoying not knowing what the hell is coming, but knowing that it's going to be dark and scary and huge.
Well, with a mentor, it's almost like you have this pillar of like, look, this is what you could become. So, this is what... If Mia had a mentor, you could say, okay, Mia could become this if she works with this person.
I think you get that throughout the whole series. You get these versions of Mia's that could happen if she makes a certain choice.
Like,
the great thing is
they don't, like, tag her on or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the reason why I killed Cassius at the end of book one. So Cassius, if you haven't read it, I've just spoiled the part of the book for you. So... But he could have potentially been a mentor figure. He was someone who was older and wiser in the world than Mia was, and he was a Darkin, and he had a better grasp of his own abilities. But I didn't want to lean on that trope. I didn't want there to be a wise man on the mentor.
I like that she has to rely on herself.
It's nice because it's scary. It's like there's no safety net
That's
here.
It.
There's no training wheels. She's just got to try and figure it out.
And in a book where characters actually die... And
so
could
much.
Happen. Anything could happen to her. And
I don't know why I'm consistently surprised by that because you
like
always
keeps
do
happening.
Book,
more.
Book one tells you that Mia is dead at the end of the story. Like, the first page of this series tells you that she is dead at the time but the like person is writing the story.
When, yeah.
And how.
And how, yeah. And why. And...
But no one is safe. The protagonist can die.
Everyone, yes. You're okay. I'm sorry to speak over the top of you. It's one of my worst things in these podcasts I trammel over.
It's your passion.
But, like, what I meant to say was that I'm constantly surprised by the way that you were able to get us to care about a character, even if they've only been around for, say, like, you know, a chapter or so. You get the sense that they're an established character that's going to stick around. Right, I'm getting to know you. You've got a purpose. Oh, wait, you horribly died right before my eyes in the worst, most tragic, poignant way ever. And now I have to try and recover from that. Like, I still think about McNulty in Illuminate.
That was rough.
I was very fond of Jimmy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things. I was talking about this with a buddy of mine, C.S. Picat, the other day. We're talking about Game of Thrones in particular. And the idea that in the first few... We're talking about the television show. In the first few seasons of the television show, you felt like no one was safe.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone could die for any reason, and often for really pointless reasons. Like, the two great ones were... Spoilers incoming if you haven't watched Thrones, but, like, the death of Ned.
Mm.
It's just pointless. Like, it could have... The book was supposed to be about him, you know? The moment that Ned gets his head cut off, I still remember feeling like fantasy for me had... kind of changed forever.
Yeah.
And the other one that I hold up as a great example is the death of the Red Viper, who's built up for in Storm of Swords for, you know, chapters and chapters. He's this peerless fighting machine, you know, he's going to murder anyone who looks at him cockeyed, and he just gets his head squashed like an egg. Like, it's not even a glorious or brilliant poetic death. It's just brutal and ugly and horrible. And
such that was life.
But that's what life is like. Yeah. Like, you can work out into an intersection after this podcast and get hit by a car and that's it, you're dead. That's sorry it.
I really wish you hadn't said that, like, you in particular,
because you're pathetic.
Now it will happen, like,
he writes the story of our lives, he narrates.
I gotta finish the series before I die. But the thing that I noticed particularly in the last season, it feels like everyone's wearing plot armor. I'm not afraid for anyone anymore. I'm not afraid Jon Snow's gonna die. I know Dany's not gonna die. I'm not afraid for Arya. I'm not afraid for any of them anymore, because they've kind of reached the point where they have to finish telling the story, and they all have a role to play.
And we need these players. Right,
to finish the story. So I'm not afraid the way I was back in the early seasons of the show. And
Affecting your enjoyment?
No, it's still fun. Like, and, you know, we're at the grand operatic level of epic fantasy, you know, massive armies clashing and dragons. You know, it's all the good stuff. Yeah. It's the stuff we've been waiting 7 seasons to get. We're finally getting. We're almost getting too much of it, though. I haven't actually finished watching the season yet. I'm up to episode 3. It feels like a lot of it's being compressed into a very short space of time. But
they are chewing through plot.
Right.
And I don't even care. Like, normally I would care. I'd be like, it's a different pace now and everything's weird and this is not the show I'm used to. But it doesn't matter with Game of Thrones because I've been waiting so long.
Right, and you can feel the ending coming. You can see it coming. So
I'm like, by all means, speed through it. Like, it's grand and big and huge, and I have no complaints. But certainly agree with you that there isn't that same sense that anyone drops dead at any moment.
You're not afraid.
Whereas
very much still present in God's grace.
Right. That's what I was kind of
circle back to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was one of the aspects that I loved, even though I. Oh, you kill off characters that I love or things like that. That's the point. That's why we like it, because life is not happy and dandy all the time.
No, and it's a brutal republic. I mean, the basis for the Atreian Republic was the Roman Republic, and, you know, life was as cheap as dirt back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were rich, you were granted a certain level of protection, but even rich people got murdered all the time. Governments got overthrown constantly. It was a historical period of incredible turmoil. No one should be safe in an environment like that. Particularly not someone who is in the business of murdering people.
Exactly.
You
know,
if you're
there
a baker,
assassins.
You could expect maybe you'd live a quiet life. But if you're literally a person who murders people for money, you probably shouldn't expect to die in your bed surrounded by smiling grandchildren. This is not the way it works.
That better be how many times. I'm going to be so upset. Actually, I can't even imagine it. But
no,
I still want it for it. I think that there's great... that there's great skill and art to maintaining the high stakes when you have so many characters dropping like flies and when death is so present. So I think that that's the great thing about these books. Yes, anyone could die at any moment. Death is everywhere. Life is hard. but you still care so much for the characters because they're well drawn and they're sympathetic, and no one dies without having been present in the story somehow.
Like, right, no red shirts.
Yeah.
There are only nameless, faceless chuds. Hopefully not anyway. I'm trying to avoid that, yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, you should feel it. Like, I am using, you know, violence and brutality to kind of talk to larger lessons about, you know, the cruelty of governmental systems like this. But you should feel every death. It shouldn't just exist for the sake of illustration of how violent this world is. You know, there should be an element of tragedy in every death. It should always serve a purpose.
There very much is.
That's why I was sort of with Game of Thrones, just briefly back to that, I stopped after season 4 for a long time because I was getting sick of it, how many people died, and it didn't care anymore.
It was relentlessly grim.
Yeah, and I was like, you know,
I think it helps. I don't really care about anyone. If you, for the early seasons of Game of Thrones, I'm not saying you have to read the books, but I think if you have read the books,
true, have not read the books,
you don't get as like overdone with all the death. I don't know.
It's a fine balance because there's always expecting someone to die versus when you're never afraid that they're gonna die. And that I hate more than anything. Like, when you know that they're definitely going to make it through.
Yeah.
Like, the most recent Wonder Woman movie, I was not invested because I knew she was...
Shh, be quiet.
There's no spoiler. No spoiler. Oh, you know, because you loved it so much.
Don't speak against it, is what I'm saying.
She's fantastic. But just in terms of the plot, I was not worried at all the entire time. And there's this big epic battle, and I was like, okay.
That's exactly why I stopped reading Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah. You're like, they're never going to kill Harry.
They killed lots of people before.
Yeah, but you knew. I knew without a shadow of a doubt
that the trio
that Harry and Hermione and Ron were safe. They were bulletproof.
Yeah.
Bulletproof. And
but
like,
I guess, could you imagine though if she had? Oh,
she would have been great.
She does kill him.
It would have been great.
Did you not realise that Harry Potter dies?
No, I've seen the movies. I watched all the movies once. And I'm not going to sit here and hack on J.K. Rowling, which is reasonably successful as an author. She probably knows what she's doing. But yeah, that was the reason why I stopped reading the series. Because I wasn't afraid for the characters. Mm. And then for me to enjoy any piece of entertainment, I need to feel a sense of risk involved. I need to be afraid to fall in love with these people because they might go away.
And I really think you balance that so well in your books. Because even if maybe, you know, you think maybe Mia might not die or might not die young or something, but she could still get maimed and injured and she'll lose people that she loves and she already has. And so...
Right.
And that's still devastating to see someone that you know, have gotten attached to see them suffer.
When reading these, I'm like reasonably able to rely on the fact that Mia will be around for book 3.
You'd hope, yes.
But what's going to happen to her is much pain will she go through? How many people that she cares about will she lose? And who will she be after all of this stuff goes down? And what on earth is going to happen? I mean, again, spoilers, sorry. I cut myself off just in time. Because just in a non-spoilery way, the ending of this book is just... pretty huge and leaves you, you know.
And like, I couldn't talk to you when I finished it before you, and I couldn't talk to Sarah.
Right.
I actually think I didn't do this, but emotionally, I threw the book down, looked at the skies, and yelled, "Jay!" That's the feeling.
I got a tweet the other day from someone who broke their Kindle because they threw the Kindle at the wall.
I can understand
which is like
that.
That's the best compliment I think I've ever got. I mean, the guiding principle for me whenever I'm writing anything, is that victory needs to come with a cost. Like you were saying, people know that Mia's going to make it through to book 3 because the series is about her. It would take an extraordinarily brave author to murder the protagonist in book 2. I don't know what the book 3 would be there. I'm not that brave. So, you know, chances are she's going to make it through to the end of the story. But the question is, what price is she going to pay along the way?
Mm-hmm.
What is she going to become in pursuit of this revenge? What is she prepared to lose in order to get the things that she wants? Those are the exciting questions.
And look how much she already has lost and suffered.
And what the hell is this world going to look like when she's done with it?
When she's through.
I use this illustration a lot, but when illustrating the point, I talk about Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back. So the end of Star Wars, Luke kind of closes his eyes and pulls the trigger and blows up the Death Star. And everyone goes home and gets a medal. It's just happy and no one loses anything.
Mm.
Or at the end of Empire... you know, Luke gets his hand cut off. He finds out that his father is the most evil man in the galaxy. His best friend gets frozen in carbonite and taken away to a bounty hunter. like it ends in this huge downer. It ends in a defeat. The end of Empire Strikes Back is a defeat, but that defeat makes the victory in Jedi that much sweeter.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's the rationale that I'm trying to use. You know the rebels are going to win. You know that Darth Vader's going to get punished and evil will get punished and the good guys will go home in limousines. Like that's the way our narrative structure works. And that's what we want to happen. Like no one wants to read a book where the heroes are all dead and the villain is standing atop a charred pile of their corpses. No one wants to read that book, but...
I don't know.
The villain is really
maybe. Maybe that'll be the next book. Just a villain book. A bad person does bad things and wins.
Totally gut-wrenching at the end and makes you cry. And...
I mean, that's kind of House of Cards, right? That's pretty much the plot of House of Cards. Frank Underwood is this horrible, vicious man who gets to be president of the United States.
Are we seeing the dawn of the first idea that Jay had to write House of Cards as a fantasy?
Yeah. It all started
I'm
here.
I'm sure someone's already done it, but that would be fun. Well, I mean, that's kind of Mark Lawrence, the Prince of Thorns series. That's pretty
really?
Much...
Okay.
See, this is where we need to start writing down.
No, but I'll write them down when I, you know, listen to this later.
I am such a huge, huge, huge fan of Mia Colbert. Mm-hmm. And I love this series. And
absolutely.
I think that I really just want you to quickly write the third book.
We're a little impatient over here.
Yeah, like, you know, what if you just decided to do it? Like in time to release it in 6 months from now, like that. I'm just spitballing here. Like,
6 months would be a stretch, I think.
Yeah,
it'll probably be a year. Like I have book threes are easier to write than book twos as a general rule. You know, book one you're building the sandcastle. Book two you're adding to the sandcastle and maybe knocking down pieces of it, but the castle still needs to be there. Book three is when you get to smash everything. It's kind of like when you're a kid at the beach. It's the end of the day when you get to stomp up and down on the sandcastle before the tide comes and takes
it.
That's a great analogy.
God's grave in ruins.
Smush sandcastle.
And I kind of love it.
I mean, it's all there. The book tells you right at the start how the book ends. So, I know. I have a pretty good idea where it's going to go. So I don't imagine, touch wood, it's going to take me an enormous amount of time to write. But 6 months, I think, is an ask.
Well, I'm happy to wait a little because it's nice to space it out. I don't want it to be over, though. That's my point. I don't want to suffer through the end.
I only get to that point of not wanting it to be over when it's over. I'm like rabid until that point. And then it's
right.
Just like, oh no, it's all gone.
I mean, I have
binge eat and then
two
like,
other books coming out between now and
let's
then anyway.
Those.
So like if you're desperate to read something by me, then you can read one of those.
Thank you for bringing us back on track.
See,
can
that segue? See how
what's
good
up next to you then?
So in March, we have the third Illuminae book coming out, which is called Obsidio. So that's myself and Amy Coffin, who's another Melbourne author. So that's the third part of that trilogy. So again, that's us knocking down all the sandcastles
so
that we
excited.
Built. And we're in the middle of looking through all the design passes now. So it's virtually done. And it looks amazing visually.
Mm-hmm.
I got the latest round of PDFs 2 or 3 days ago and was just blown away at how cool this thing looks.
My God.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we're really proud of the story. We've given it the ending that we think readers want. It's big and epic and operatic and tragic. So yeah, that's
yes.
fun. So that's coming out in March. And then in May, I have a new YA series coming out. So it's a little less sexy and sweary and stabby than Nevernight was, and that's called Lifelike. So that is I'm likening it to a cross between Mad Max Fury Road and Blade Runner. So it's kind
wow.
of a post-apocalyptic story about androids and humans and a war between them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that's coming out in May next year, and then
lots to look forward to.
The third book of Nevernight will come out after that. So I'm pretty busy.
And you've also got another series with Amy, right?
Yeah. So we're in the middle of writing that now. That's called The Andromeda Cycle at the moment. So we're working on book one of that, and that comes out in March of 2019.
It's actually mind-blowing how many books that
there's
you're
a lot.
Are churning out. Like, it's amazing. You know, I still want Nevernight 3 in 6 months, but having said that, I understand why you can't do it.
That would be great if I could do it, but I'm just not that fast, unfortunately. I mean, the
I'm just greedy.
The good thing about working with Amy is you're really only writing half a book. I mean, technically it's probably more like 2/3 because you're bouncing ideas back and forth. But we tend to write them relatively quickly because we plot very intensely at the start. We know exactly what we're doing before we start writing, and then we churn them out. So those books, while not easy to write, they're less time consuming, I guess, than something like Nevernight. They're also shorter, I guess. The Illuminated book's probably about 100,000 words, and God's Grave is 170, 180. But then I look at someone like George R. R. Martin, who's putting out 500,000 word books, or Pat Rothfuss, you know.
Yeah.
I think Wise Man's Fear was something like 800,000 words or something.
But I mean, George R. R. Martin's doing it every 6 or 7 years.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, George R. R. Martin is super rich. So
he can take his time.
I'm going to pay him on a phone bill.
Well, you chose a sensational way of doing that. I'm really glad that you chose this way of paying your phone bills.
I mean, I'm very lucky in the sense that I get to do it full time. Like, this is my job now, which I'm incredibly fortunate to do, particularly working as an author in Australia. It's very difficult to make a living in any kind of artistic endeavor in Australia. So I'm very lucky and very grateful that I get to do this as a day job at all. So, yeah. Thanks for reading, everyone.
I think the readers are lucky too.
I think so. Well, Jay, thanks so much. We probably should wrap it up there because I feel like we could just go on forever and ever and ever.
Okay.
But thank you so much for chatting with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me again. It's always fun.
And we look forward to having you back, I hope, very soon.
Definitely. Yes. Love to.
In 6 months.
In 6 months. For the third in the series, right?
We'll see you next year.
Okay.
And podcast listeners, you can get God's Grave and all of Jay's books
that he's written by himself and with various people
at booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.